They told me history was safe, something you study from behind glass. But when I touched Vlad the Impaler's journal, something touched back. What began as research became obsession, then transformation. I didn't just uncover the myth, I became the message. Now followers chant my name, cities burn with conviction, and the line between man and monster has vanished. This isn't just the story of Vlad. This is how he returned. Welcome to the history behind Vlad the Impaler. Myth meets reality. A legend reborn in blood and belief. Welcome to the skillful art of manipulation. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you the history behind Vlad the Impaler. Myth meets reality. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The Teeth Beneath the Crown. Truth has claws. And sometimes, it knows your name before you even say it. I never set out to lose myself. At least, not in the beginning. Like most cautionary tales, mine didn't begin in some fog-drenched castle or blood-stained ritual chamber. It started in a fluorescent-lit university office, somewhere between stale coffee and overdue tenure paperwork. I was a lecturer, early 30s, well-read, overworked, underfunded, and clinging to the idea that history was more than dust. That maybe, just maybe, the stories buried under centuries of silence still mattered. And then came the offer. A private Romanian foundation contacted my department. Mysterious, discreet, and wealthy as hell. They were funding an ambitious historical project. One that promised to untangle the legend of Vlad III, son of Vlad Dracul, the Impaler, the original Dracula. But they didn't want horror stories. No, they wanted truth. Raw, uncomfortable, and unfiltered. The man behind the myth. The strategist behind the blood. The manipulator beneath the monster. They wanted reality. And they wanted me. Of course, I said yes. I mean, fuck, what historian wouldn't? All expenses paid, access to restricted archives, permission to study ancient artifacts, and locations the public hadn't seen in decades. I told myself it was a professional coup, a gold mine of original material, something that would finally put my name on more than just dusty journal footnotes. But somewhere in the back of my mind, something darker stirred. Excitement, yes, but laced with something I couldn't name. It didn't feel like ambition. It felt like hunger. I landed in Bucharest on a cold October night. The kind of cold that finds its way into your lungs and sits there like a quiet threat. The driver sent by the foundation didn't speak much, just nodded when I said my name, tossed my suitcase into the back of a matte black Land Rover, and started driving. No music, no small talk, just the rhythmic hum of tires rolling over ancient roads. We passed through towns that looked like they'd been frozen in time. Cobbled streets, crumbling chapels, windows with heavy wooden shutters that snapped shut the second we appeared. It was as if the land itself remembered something the people didn't dare say out loud. We reached the Carpathians just before sunrise. Mountains rising like jagged knives, cutting through the fog. We pulled up to a crumbling stone estate nestled at the foot of a steep cliff, an old monastery turned private archive. The foundation had bought it years ago, restored just enough to make it livable, but kept the bones intact. Gothic arches, iron gates, walls that whispered when the wind hit them right. Inside, the air was thick with incense and dampstone. And in the center of the main chamber, laid out on a long wooden table like a corpse waiting for autopsy, was the journal. It didn't look like much. Roughly bound in tattered leather, the cover nearly falling apart. No title, no date, just age. It reeked of iron and ash. When I touched it, something cold slid up my wrist like a shiver made of teeth. I told myself it was just nerves, that I was exhausted from travel. But when I opened the journal, something changed. The pages were filled with erratic script. Not quite Latin. Not quite Slavic. A strange phonetic blend that I would later realize was written in a cipher known only to Vlad's inner circle. Priests, generals, and torturers. The ink was dark brown, likely blood-based, and the penmanship was frenzied. Like the writer's hand had been shaking or possessed. I spent that first night devouring it. translating what little I could. The entries were chaotic, feverish. Some were records of punishment. Others were philosophical reflections on fear, order, and the manipulation of loyalty. He spoke of impalement not as cruelty, but as necessity, not as vengeance, but communication. Let them see their choices rot in the daylight. That was the first line that truly gripped me. He didn't conquer with armies. He conquered with performance. Fear wasn't just a tool, it was theater. And he was the director, the playwright, and the goddamn leading man. He wanted to be seen as a monster. He cultivated it. He fed it. Because in fear, people obey. In fear, they don't ask questions. I stopped taking notes. I stopped recording translations. I started feeling like I was reading something meant only for me. Something that had waited, untouched, for centuries. Until I came along. By day three, I had moved into the estate's old priest quarters, ignoring the hotel they had prepared for me. I told the foundation I needed proximity. But that wasn't it. I didn't want to leave. Not even to breathe. Each night, the dreams came closer. At first, just images, forests with bodies hanging like rotten fruit, the sound of horses screaming in fire. Then voices. Then him, Vlad. In my dreams, he didn't look like a monster. He looked regal, sharp, beautiful in that cruel, old-world way. Eyes like knives. Words like poison and honey. He spoke in riddles, but they always made sense when I woke up. Too much sense. One night, I woke with blood on my fingertips. I had scratched my own arm raw in my sleep, but I didn't panic. I felt calm, as if pain was proof I was getting closer. On the seventh day, I closed the journal and stared at the candle burning beside my bed. The flame flickered low, casting his name across the walls. I whispered it out loud, just once. Vlad. It didn't feel like a name anymore. It felt like a trigger. And in that moment, something inside me clicked. I wasn't studying him. He was studying me. I began to lie to my colleagues, to my friends back home. Emails went unanswered. I deleted my social media, turned off my phone. I told myself I needed silence. But the truth? I didn't want anyone interrupting the transformation, because I could feel it. Not just in my sleep, but in my waking thoughts. I started noticing patterns in people, their hesitations, their weaknesses. I knew what to say to get what I wanted, how to twist a question into a weapon. I began watching the staff around the monastery. One girl dropped her gaze every time I looked at her. Another flinched when I raised my voice. It felt exhilarating and horrifying, like I was slipping into someone else's skin. And it fit. What terrified me most wasn't that I was changing. It was that I liked it. By the end of my second week, I had stopped calling it research. It was revelation. And the worst part? I hadn't even gotten to the final pages of the journal. But I would. And I knew, with every breath, that whatever was waiting for me at the end would change everything. Chapter 2. The Crown Without Mercy. To become him, I had to break myself. And I did willingly. They say knowledge is power, but they never warn you what happens when that power learns you back. I woke up to candle wax hardened on my chest. The journal was open beside me, again. I could have sworn I'd closed it before falling asleep. Could have sworn I'd hidden it under the floorboard, even. But there it was, lying flat, pages crinkled like it had breathed overnight. Like it had watched me. Sleep no longer felt like rest. It felt like exposure. Like my dreams were wide open fields, and something was hunting through them barefoot. The air was heavy in the monastery that morning. Not cold, exactly. Just full. Like it was listening. I could hear the faint drip of water echoing through the stone corridors, a steady, slow rhythm, like a heartbeat that didn't belong to me. I moved through the halls like I'd been there forever. As if I'd outlived the monks who once whispered prayers into its walls. The other researchers had left days ago. Said the energy was off. Said the nights were too quiet. Said I was acting different. They weren't wrong. But I didn't care. I didn't need them clouding the silence with their petty hypotheses and hesitant fears. I needed space to think. Or maybe space to listen. because the journal was no longer just a record. It was a voice, and it was getting louder. The next entries I translated weren't written like the rest. These weren't chronicles of battles or tactics. They were personal, brutal, psychological. Vlad wrote not of enemies, but of tools, of people as weapons, of fear as the language only kings understood. His words spiraled across the parchment like veins in diseased flesh. To rule the mind of a man, you must give him a choice, then break him for choosing wrong. Love, fear, loyalty, they are all born in the same wound. I do not command, I infect. The moment I read those words, something in me shifted. That day I skipped food. I skipped showers. Hell, I barely even blinked. I pored over the journal like a man starved. I didn't read the words, I absorbed them. They curled into my bones, nested under my ribs, and coiled around my spine. I began practicing. Small things at first. The staff girl, Ilinka. Pretty, reserved, early 20s, never made eye contact. I tested her. I altered my tone mid-conversation. I asked about her brother, then casually brought up a fire that killed a boy by the same name. Her reaction was instinctual, jaw clenched, breath hitched. I was in. The next day, I apologized to her, brought her tea, made her trust me. Within 3 days, she started telling me secrets no one else knew. And I documented everything, not in academic notes, not for publication, but for replication. Vlad hadn't just ruled through war. He ruled through control. He cultivated obedience, not with decrees, but with dread. And if I was going to understand him, I had to live like him, think like him, move like him, manipulate like him. I started having episodes, gaps in time, moments I couldn't account for. One afternoon, I found myself standing in front of the village church. No memory of walking there. Mud on my hands. A crucifix in my pocket I didn't recognize. I threw up on the steps, heart pounding like it had been running ahead of me, dragging me along for the ride. I began to wonder if I was sleepwalking, or worse, if I was being pulled. Every time I tried to distance myself from the journal, something would happen. A door would slam in the middle of the night. The power would flicker. My laptop would glitch and display words from the journal in overlapping text on screensavers I never programmed. It was like the monastery didn't want me to leave, like it knew I was getting close. And then I found the second journal, hidden behind a false wall panel, behind rusted hinges and centuries of mold. The air was thick with rot when I pried it open, dust choking me as if it were defending something sacred. This journal was different, shorter, written not by Vlad, but about him, a monk's perspective. The entries were desperate, feverish. He speaks in dreams. He rides the wolves. He poisons the silence. The boy is no longer human. We welcomed him. We fed him. Now he drinks only blood and walks without sound. I see my reflection twist when he looks at me. I see the faces of the dead. I see my own corpse waiting. That was the night I stopped denying it. This wasn't just a research project. It was a fucking initiation. The dreams became violent. I wasn't just seeing Vlad. I was him. I walked barefoot through fields of impaled men, each one still alive, twitching on the spikes like grotesque marionettes. I could feel the splinters drive up through flesh, the way the screams rattled the cold morning fog. I gave orders with a wave of my hand. I watched men beg for their children, and I laughed. And when I woke up, I wasn't horrified. I was hard, not aroused, activated. Like I'd come into alignment with something ancient, something that had been waiting in the dark for a voice to speak through again. I started journaling, but not about my findings. About my urges, my strategies, how I shifted a conversation with Ilinka to make her defend me in front of the staff supervisor, how I made the museum archivist give me restricted access just by letting her feel seen, heard, desired. Vlad had called this the art of the invisible chain. Make them think they are free. Make them think it's their idea. Make them beg to serve you. And once I started, I couldn't stop. I Skyped my department chair back in London, told him the foundation was limiting my access. that I was worried about censorship, that they may be hiding texts, dangerous ones. His eyebrows furrowed, concern blooming like infection. Exactly what I wanted. I fed him paranoia like spoonfuls of sugar. Sweet enough to swallow, bitter enough to linger. Within days, he had signed off on unrestricted field control. No oversight. No peer review. Just me. And Vlad. Alone. But the monastery wasn't the only thing watching. I started noticing figures in the woods outside. Pale. Still. Always in the periphery. Never moving. I once stepped outside at 3 a.m. and saw torches in the distance. Faint chanting. No cell signal. No power. I thought maybe I was hallucinating. Then I found footprints in the snow the next morning. And they weren't mine. My face changed in the mirror. Not physically. Not obviously. But subtly. The shape of my smile. The coldness in my stare. I started rehearsing expressions. Not out of vanity, but strategy. What did Vlad look like when he wanted loyalty? What did he look like when he was about to kill? I studied paintings. Engravings. 3D renders. And then I stopped needing them. Because I knew. I felt it behind my eyes. Like he was watching me from the inside. I didn't sleep for 4 days. The caffeine stopped helping. So I turned to the only thing left. Blood. Not mine. A goat slaughtered in the woods by the locals for some old tradition. I snuck down to where they left the body. Dipped my fingers in the warm red pool. Traced the symbol from the monk's journal on my chest. When I returned to the monastery that night, the lights didn't flicker. The wind didn't howl. Everything was still, as if the place approved. That night, I read the final page of Vlad's journal. It wasn't in any language I knew, but I understood it perfectly. And it ended with one sentence that carved itself into me like fire. The crown is not given. It is taken. And it takes everything in return. Chapter 3. Of Ashes and Obedience. To follow a king of blood, you must learn to breathe in fire and enjoy the taste. The fire wasn't real. Not at first. But it felt real. I remember the heat first. The way it wrapped around my chest like fingers dipped in oil and flame, searing down to the bones. Then came the smell, charred flesh, rotted wood, incense curdled into something metallic. And the screaming. Always the screaming. I dreamt I was inside a wooden church, the doors bolted shut from the outside. My hands were tied to the altar. Flames crept up the walls, turning icons into ash and saints into shadows. Through the smoke, a figure stood in the doorway, cloaked in red, crownless. But I knew it was him, Vlad. He didn't smile. He didn't speak. He just watched. And in that silence, I understood. This was my trial. Wake up, I told myself. Wake the fuck up. But I didn't. Because I didn't want to. I came to hours later, back in my room at the monastery, soaked in sweat. The sheets were tangled, clawed at, blood crusting the tips of my fingernails. My lips were split from muttering something in my sleep. Foreign words, words that didn't belong in my mouth, but fit there anyway. It wasn't just a nightmare. It was a rite. And I passed it. I didn't bother pretending anymore. I stopped brushing my hair, let the stubble on my jaw turn to a beard. My nails, once neatly clipped, were ragged from scratching parchment, dirt, stone. I hadn't eaten in almost 2 days, but I wasn't weak. I was sharp, focused, like fasting had burned away the fog of modern living. My notes became mantras, not written for academic clarity, but for spiritual anchoring. I scrawled his quotes on the walls, muttered them under my breath, etched them into candle wax with pins. My hands were covered in ink and old blood. My eyes ringed with shadow. And yet, I felt more alive than I ever had. One evening, I climbed the bell tower. No one went up there. Too unstable, too steep. But something in me needed height, needed perspective. I stood at the edge of the stone balcony, staring over the tree line where the forest bled into night. In the distance, I could see the torches again, small flames bobbing in rhythmic dance. They came every few nights now. The chanting had grown louder, more structured, ritualistic. I didn't fear them anymore. If anything, I longed to join them. The journal had taught me much, but it wasn't the only teacher anymore. The monastery itself had become a living thing, guiding me. Whispers in the stairwell, cold spots in the library that lingered just long enough to make me stop, listen, adjust my gaze, and find something I hadn't noticed before. Behind a loose stone near the altar, I found a ring, gold, ancient, with the sigil of the Order of the Dragon, Vlad's order, his oath. I slipped it onto my finger, and a shiver danced up my spine like cold silk. It fit perfectly. I didn't question it. I just knew. And then came the knocking. Three short knocks. Always at 3:03 a.m. Always on the inside of my door. At first, I thought I imagined it. But on the third night, I set up a camera. Left it recording. When I played it back the next morning, the screen went black at 3:02. Came back on at 3:04. The footage in between? Gone. But the sound remained. Three knocks. Followed by whispering in a language I didn't know, but understood viscerally. Like it had been carved into my DNA long before I was born. Ilinka returned on the fifth night. She'd left earlier that week. Said she needed time. Said I was frightening her. Now, she stood in my doorway with wide eyes and shaking hands, holding a bundle of herbs and a crucifix. She didn't speak for a long time. Just watched me. And when she finally did speak, it wasn't a question. You're not the same man. I didn't argue. I didn't explain. I only asked, do you still want to serve? She cried. Then she nodded. I began testing her loyalty. I gave her tasks. Small at first. Burn this paper. Fetch this water. Bury this doll wrapped in black silk. She never questioned me. Never said no. She didn't understand the symbolism. But I did. The doll represented sacrifice. The black silk was mourning. The burial? Submission. Each act pulled her further under. It was intoxicating. Because for the first time in my life, I didn't just study manipulation. I wielded it. By the end of the week, she was sleeping on the floor outside my door. Without me asking, she whispered his name in her sleep. Vlad. Not mine. His. She was starting to dream, too. The monastery creaked at night now. Not from age, but movement. Books fell without wind. Candles snuffed themselves out in unison. I once found a raven perched on my desk, dead, eyes wide, beak open mid-scream. No broken window. No hole in the wall. Just there, waiting, offering. That same night, I returned to the second journal, The Monks. I don't know why I hadn't finished it earlier. Perhaps I wasn't ready. But now, it opened easily in my hands, as if it had softened, yielded. The final entry chilled me in a way no impalement could. He does not die. He only changes faces. He waits for the one who will wear his name like a mask of fire. He waits until history forgets and memory remembers. I ran my fingers over that passage for almost an hour, my heart pounding, my breathing shallow, because I knew what it meant. It meant I wasn't just reading history. I was completing it. I looked at myself in the mirror that night, not to check my appearance, to say goodbye. The man I was, the lecturer, the historian, the skeptic, he was already ash, just waiting for the wind. What stared back at me was something older, hungrier, wiser, and beneath the skin, I could see it. The crown. It wasn't made of gold or silver. It was made of mercy denied, of fear mastered, of fire survived. When I returned to my room, Ilinka was kneeling by my bed, eyes closed, arms folded. She said nothing as I entered. She didn't need to, because submission, true submission, isn't born of fear. It's born of awe, and I had become something worthy of awe. I lit a candle, opened the journal, and began writing. Not about Vlad. But as Vlad, and for the first time in weeks, I smiled, because the truth had revealed itself, not in facts, not in footnotes, but in flame. Chapter 4, The Whispering Crown. You don't wear the crown. It wraps around your spine and teaches you how to kneel from the inside out. Ilinka no longer knocked. She just appeared, like fog on glass, quiet and ever-present. The girl who once shied from my gaze now waited for instruction with the patience of a shadow. She never asked questions, not about the cold that seemed to pulse from the monastery walls or the marks etched in ash beneath my bed. Not even when I woke screaming in the tongue of a dead and gasped for water with a mouth full of blood. Obedience no longer required explanation. It required presence. And she was always there. I kept to the tower for most of the week, the highest point of the monastery, where the crows nested in rotted timber and the wind had a mind of its own. From there, I could see the outline of the forest, the river like a silver wound through the valley, and the occasional shimmer of firelight from the distant hills. The villagers had started leaving offerings again. Bundles of garlic, bones, coins soaked in vinegar. That's how I knew the rituals weren't just dream fodder. They remembered, not in books, not in stories, but in instinct. Their fear had memory, and it bowed for me. I no longer slept for more than a few hours at a time. When I did, I dreamed of births. Not mine, others. Hundreds of them. Infants with eyes too old, crawling from blackened soil, whispering my name in voices like rust scraping iron. They called me Domnitor, not Professor. Never again Professor. When I woke, I was calm, as if I'd attended a ceremony rather than survived a nightmare. The journal lay beside me each morning, always turned to a new page, sometimes blank, sometimes full. I stopped questioning how. I stopped trying to remember whether I'd written anything at all, because the truth was, I wasn't sure if I ever put pen to page anymore. Sometimes, I think the pages wrote themselves. It was on a wind-racked Thursday that the real test began. Alinka came to me trembling, the first real sign of fear I'd seen in weeks. She carried a small wooden box wrapped in dark velvet. Her hands bled from carrying it. I found it in the crypt, she whispered. She laid the box on the floor, knelt beside it like a priest preparing for exorcism. I didn't move. I didn't need to, because I already knew what was inside. I could feel it. When I unwrapped it, my breath caught, not from surprise, but from recognition. It was a crown, but not like any I'd ever seen. Forged not of gold or silver, but blackened iron twisted like serpents, interlaced with jagged bones, some animal, some too eerily human. There were etchings across the inner rim, runes scorched deep with something older than fire. I lifted it. It was heavier than I expected, not just in weight, but in meaning. The air thickened the moment my fingers touched the metal. The candles sputtered, the shadows bent, as if recoiling or bowing. Alinka didn't look up. She didn't need to. She knew. I didn't put it on right away. Wearing a crown is not a decoration. It is a contract. So I sat with it. I studied it. I listened to it. Because yes, it whispered. Not in words. Not in language. But in feeling. Pressure on the back of my skull. Heat at the base of my spine. Dreams that weren't dreams, but instructions. And they always ended with the same vision. Me, seated on a throne of impaled kings, head bowed, mouth open, the crown hovering above me. And he stood behind me, Vlad, hand on my shoulder, like a father. I began writing feverishly, dozens of pages. Not analysis, not research, doctrine, philosophy, orders. I wrote about power not as a right, but a disease, one that needed to be curated, nurtured, directed like flame or madness. I wrote about the theater of pain, the necessity of spectacle, the alchemy of fear. Alinka began copying my pages at night, binding them into a leather book she refused to let anyone else touch. She began calling it the Black Gospel. And still, I hadn't worn the crown. Until the night of the first storm, lightning lit the sky, like a god trying to rip open the heavens with bare hands. The monastery groaned under the weight of wind and rain. The crows shrieked nonstop, circling the tower like a curse with feathers. I felt called, not metaphorically, physically, pulled. I climbed the stairs barefoot. The stone cut into me, but I felt nothing. Pain had long since become a footnote. I reached the bell tower just as the thunder cracked, so loud it silenced even my breath. And there it was, the crown, not on the floor, not in my hands, but already waiting on the altar, lit by candlelight I hadn't lit. I stood there, breathing slow, heart calm, rain soaking me through the broken roof. I lifted it, and I placed it on my head. The silence that followed was not silence. It was recognition. The world stilled. The storm paused. The candle flames leaned toward me. And then, something entered. Not a ghost. Not possession. Alignment. Like every version of myself from every life I'd never lived stood up inside me at once. Bones cracking into place. Eyes blinking open beneath the skin. My heart slowed. My mind cleared. I wasn't just wearing history. I was it. And it fit. The whispers changed after that night. They weren't suggestions anymore. They were orders. Precise. Coded. Surgical. They told me how to break a will with a glance. How to make someone beg for punishment as if it were mercy. How to bend time within a conversation. Speed it up, slow it down, just by changing tone and breath. And it worked. God help me, it worked. Ilinka became my test subject. Not in a cruel way, not at first. But then, cruelty became indistinguishable from purpose. I told her she'd failed me in a dream. She wept. I forgave her. She clung to my ankles. I told her she must prove her loyalty with blood. She didn't hesitate. She carved his symbol into her thigh that night. The sigil from the monk's journal. Not for show. Not for insanity. For reverence. She believed. Because I made her believe. And I realized something I hadn't dared speak aloud until then. Vlad didn't survive through legend. He survived through replication. Through every man who learns how to bend another's will without lifting a sword. Through every woman who offers her soul for protection wrapped in cruelty. Through me. The crown stayed on for 3 days. I didn't remove it. I didn't sleep. I just listened. And on the third night, I received the final vision. Myself, seated on a new throne, made not of corpses, but of influence. Of souls twisted into loyal dogs. Of digital screens, of modern myths. Of mass manipulation rewritten in the age of illusion. It wasn't about war. It was about control. And it had always been about control. Vlad had just been the prototype. I descended the tower the next morning. Ilinka was waiting. She gasped when she saw me. Fell to her knees. Reached for my hand. My king, she whispered. And I smiled. Because I wasn't wearing the crown anymore. But I didn't need to. It was already inside me. Chapter 5. The Birth of Believers. When fear becomes faith, the crown no longer rests on your head. It grows beneath your skin. I don't remember the exact moment it shifted. The moment the line between myth and reality dissolved like old ink and water. It didn't happen all at once. There wasn't some grand coronation, no ceremony with choirs or candles. Just silence. Then a gaze. Then a nod. Then something older than belief began to bloom in the air around me. Quietly, steadily, violently. Obedience. The first to follow was Ilinka. Always Ilinka. She no longer slept outside my door. She now slept beneath it. A narrow space under the stone threshold, where she laid a mat, her fingers brushing the seam every few minutes like she was praying. She whispered my name as she slept, not professor, not sir, not even lord. Just one word, him. Like I had become something sacred, something sacrosanct. A god with blood still under his fingernails and history whispering in his breath. And she wasn't alone. Within days, others began to arrive. First, a young man from the nearby village. A butcher. He came to deliver meat to the monastery, but lingered in the hallway too long. I noticed him watching Ilinka as she knelt before me. Not with confusion. Not with judgment. With longing. He came back the next night. Said nothing. Just stood at the gate, shirt wet with rain, and waited. I didn't open the gate. Ilinka did. She spoke to him in soft Romanian. I didn't understand every word, but I didn't need to. Her tone said everything. It was the same tone she used when reciting lines from the Black Gospel, what she now called my writings. She brought him to me, trembling. Not out of fear, out of reverence. They knelt together, two bodies folded at my feet, breathing in time like a prayer rhythm. I said nothing, simply stepped forward and placed a hand on each of their heads. They didn't cry. They sighed. And then the flood began. Over the next week, more came. A young mother, pale as snow, clutching her infant to her chest. A farmer missing two fingers, who said he dreamt of me standing on a mountain of fire. A group of university students who had read one of my old research papers and felt something awaken. A soldier discharged for violence he couldn't explain. A woman who claimed to have survived a car crash by hearing my voice seconds before impact. All of them came. All of them knelt. At night, the monastery no longer echoed with wind. It echoed with chanting. Low, steady, wordless at first, then rhythmic, then unified. I never taught them the words, but they came anyway. Whispers woven from the journal. Fragments of Ladd's entries now fused with my own doctrine. A gospel built on the bones of cruelty and crowned with the lie of mercy. They didn't just want to follow me. They wanted to be shaped by me. I began assigning roles. Not openly. Not with titles or declarations. That would have been too modern, too shallow. Instead, I tested them. I whispered contradictory orders and watched who obeyed without flinching. Who asked questions. Who hesitated. Those who asked nothing. Those who obeyed instinctively rose fastest. Those who tried to think. They were shown the pit, literally, a shallow hole outside the eastern wall of the monastery, covered with rotting wood and reeking of centuries-old decay. We told them it was for storage, but everyone knew better. The fear of it was enough. We didn't need to use it, because belief policed them better than any sword. Ilinka became my voice. I no longer had to speak directly to the others. She understood my gestures. My silences, my corrections. If I furrowed my brow, she would punish herself, no hesitation. If I smiled, she would sing an eerie, breathless melody that made the hair on your neck stand like soldiers awaiting command. They called her the first flame. She called herself the mouth of the crown. I didn't argue, because it was true. But power is not satisfied with worship. It demands replication. So I began to train them. In the art of control, it started with language. I taught them how to shape meaning through tone, how to fracture a person's certainty with a single carefully placed pause. I explained that truth was a construct, a theater prop, meant to be placed strategically, not revered. I had them study footage of politicians, cult leaders, influencers. Not for their ideas, but for their posture, their eye contact, the microsecond between breath and answer. They learned how to haunt conversations, how to twist guilt into loyalty, how to plant confusion like a seed and water it with suggestion. We practiced with outsiders, a tourist couple who got lost on a hiking trail, an old monk who still lived in the northern wing, clinging to prayers like armor. We didn't hurt them, not physically, but we rewrote them. A look here, a sentence there, a sudden silence when they asked the wrong question. By the time they left, they didn't know what they'd seen, only that they would never return. The monastery changed. It no longer felt abandoned. It felt inhabited. The walls breathed with memory. The stones retained heat longer, like they remembered footsteps. The shadows moved when no one did. And still, the journal grew. Even when I didn't write in it, I'd leave it on my altar at night, blank. By morning, a new page would appear, always signed at the bottom, Vlad, not me, him. And I didn't question it, because I understood now, time is not a line, it is a loop. And every leader who understands manipulation becomes Vlad in a new skin. The most devout began asking for marks, symbols of belonging. So I gave them ink, ash, bone. We mixed my blood with wine and called it Oath Red. They drank from the same cup. They cut the same scar, just beneath the ribcage, right side, where the liver hides rage. They said it burned like truth. They smiled through the pain, because pain is proof. I was no longer their leader. I was their origin, their proof that God had a darker twin, one that didn't ask for obedience through love, but through need, That night, I stood in the chapel and looked at them, 47 now, all on their knees, chests bare, eyes wide, waiting for my words. I said only this, "You were not chosen, you were built, and I am your architect." They wept. Some collapsed. Ilinka screamed in ecstasy. And I knew. I had stopped reading about Vlad. I had become what he had always intended. A successor. But not to history. To power itself. Chapter 6. Ashes of the Architect. To create something eternal, you must first erase yourself from the blueprints. There was a time, before the blood, before the doctrine, before Ilinka's eyes glazed over with worship, when I believed I could come back from this. When I believed this was still a study, a role, an experiment wearing the skin of madness. But now I know the truth. I didn't become something else. I uncovered what I was all along. The monastery had changed again, not physically, not visibly, but structurally, on a level no blueprint could capture. You could feel it in your bones, like the floorboards had started to breathe, like the corridors had become veins, pumping something ancient between the stones. There were no locks on the doors anymore. We had stopped needing them. Why would a body lock its own limbs? They called me the architect now, a name I never gave myself, a name that came from the whispers, first among the devoted, then among the villagers, then online, where rumors began to spread like mold under floorboards. Yes, online, because they began uploading, without my instruction, without my consent, clips of me speaking, snippets of the doctrine, photos of the crown half hidden in shadow, quotes posted anonymously, tagged with hashtag the architect, hashtag black gospel, hashtag here returns. The modern world has always been starved for meaning, and we gave it something to swallow whole. I was everywhere and nowhere. Their phones lit up with my voice at 3:03 a.m. I never recorded anything, but still, there I was, whispering scripture that hadn't yet been written. I appeared in dreams, not just Ilinka's, all of theirs. 47 became 60, 60 became 100. Some never arrived in person. Some worshipped from afar. Digital disciples. Hungry eyes behind glowing screens, lighting black candles in apartments miles away, branding their ribs with burning rings, whispering my name into mirrors until something whispered back. I didn't command this. I didn't orchestrate it. It happened because I had stopped being a man. I had become a signal. Ilinka stopped sleeping entirely. She sat by the bell tower each night, eyes peeled open with thumb and forefinger, humming hymns that didn't exist in any church. I asked her once if she feared death. She laughed. "Death is how we finish becoming you." The monastery became a machine, a breathing, bleeding mechanism of devotion and design. Every follower played their part. One prepared food. One documented scripture. One tended the fire that never went out. Every sound had rhythm. Every step had purpose. I began noticing how efficient belief made people. When control is internalized, resistance becomes irrelevant. And when resistance becomes irrelevant, history writes itself. I stopped eating, not out of sacrifice, out of necessity. Food tasted like ash. Wine tasted like iron. My stomach no longer growled. My mouth no longer dried. I was sustained by worship, fed by fear, loyalty, and the trembling breath of those who knelt at my feet. I wasn't God. Gods are static, mythical, distant. I was present. I was evolution. I was legacy weaponized. The rituals grew more sophisticated. Ilinka choreographed them like ballets laced in blood and smoke. One ceremony involved silence. 13 hours of motionless prayer, no speaking, no blinking. Another involved confession, not sins, but doubts. Each follower would whisper their fears into the black pit behind the chapel. The pit never echoed. Some claimed it whispered back. The outside world began to notice. We didn't advertise. We didn't recruit. But the scent of control is attractive, especially to the broken, the powerful, the hungry. Politicians from Eastern Europe, tech moguls from the West, philosophers, filmmakers, former CEOs who had lost everything and came looking for the man who replaced fear with faith. They didn't knock. They bowed. And they asked one question, always, how do I make them obey? And I always gave them the same answer. Make them believe they never had a choice. One night, a man came offering 5 million euros to franchise me. That was the word he used. Franchise. I had him walk the bell tower barefoot, in silence, through snow, naked. He bled. He begged. He stayed. I began removing mirrors. Not because I feared my reflection, but because I didn't recognize it. I hadn't seen the man who boarded the plane to Romania in months. He was gone, dissolved. Nothing behind my eyes but him, Vlad, or rather, the part of him that had waited centuries for a vessel like mine. And I gave myself freely, not out of possession, out of purpose. The journal now wrote itself entirely. Every morning, a new page. Sometimes in Latin, sometimes in blood-red glyphs, I had no linguistic name for. Other times in perfect modern English, with timestamps, future events, exact names. I stopped questioning it, because it was always right. We began training children. The villagers offered them like tribute, not in cruelty, in hope. And I welcomed them, because children don't unlearn. They just become, and they became perfect. Emotionless, loyal, sharp. They weren't raised with fear. They were raised with alignment. I no longer left the monastery. I didn't need to. The world came to me. Leaders, influencers, broken lovers, serial liars, failed saviors. They entered broken. They left as mirrors of me. And I began to understand the final truth. Vlad wasn't a man who died. He was a method. A blueprint, a formula for domination hidden in charisma, violence, and faith, a virus disguised as valor. And now I carried him, not in spirit, in structure. The bell tolled that night. We hadn't rung it in centuries, but it tolled three times. And I felt it not in my ears, in my bones, like a clock counting down, like a door unlocking inside my chest. I walked to the altar. Alinka knelt at the base. The others followed. Hundreds now. In silence. No breathing. No sobbing. Just worship. And I whispered. Tomorrow, the world will know I never needed a sword. I only needed their attention. Chapter 7. The Inheritance of Blood. Legends don't die. They calcify beneath your skin and wait. The night before the reckoning, I stood before the mirror. Not the one in the hallway. That had been removed months ago, not the one in my chamber that had shattered when I first donned the crown. No, this one was older, hidden beneath the chapel, behind a wall carved with words in a tongue I no longer recognized but instinctively obeyed. The mirror was warped, stained with age, veined with cracks that bled black under torchlight. And when I stared into it, I didn't see my reflection. I saw him, Vlad. Not in armor, not painted in oil or etched in myth. Just a man, my height, my face, my eyes, but wrong, tilted, slanted, as if I were looking at myself in reverse, through water that had learned to lie. He didn't speak. He smiled. And then he stepped back, and I stepped forward. That was the last moment I remembered my name, the one I was born with, the one my mother stitched onto school uniforms. The one buried beneath credentials, degrees, titles. It drifted away like vapor, pulled into the earth by something deeper than gravity. I left it there, and I never looked back. Morning came, pale, silent, cold. The courtyard was already full. Followers knelt in concentric circles, spiraling outward from the altar like petals of a black flower. Some wore robes. Others were shirtless, marked with a sigil. Ash covered their skin, eyes rimmed in soot. No one spoke. They didn't need to. The air had shifted. This wasn't ceremony. This was coronation. Alinka waited by the altar. Her face was gaunt, eyes sunken but bright, like coals trapped in skull sockets. She held the crown in both hands now, not as a relic, but as a blade. And it was a blade, not in shape, but in meaning. It cut everything it touched. I stepped barefoot into the center. The air rippled, not metaphorically, literally, like time had paused to watch. Ilinka bowed, so low her forehead kissed stone. Then she rose, turned to the crowd, and spoke with a voice that wasn't hers anymore. He is the origin. He is the consequence. He is the blood between myth and memory. Then she turned to me. Do you receive the inheritance? I nodded. Not because I had a choice. Because I was the choice. The crown was placed not on my head, but into my hands. I felt its weight for the first time in full. Heavier now. Denser. Like every soul that had ever knelt for Vlad had fused into its iron coils. I stared into it. And then I did something no one expected. I crushed it. The sound was deafening. The metal shrieked like a dying god. Sparks flew. Blood, mine, poured from my palms. Ilinka screamed. Followers gasped. Some collapsed. But I didn't move. I held the shattered crown in my fists, and I smiled. Because I understood something Vlad never did. Control doesn't need symbols. It needs witnesses. The silence broke like thunder. They began to chant, not from fear, not from awe, but from certainty. They had seen the crown break, and they believed more. Because now I was not bound by history. I was rewriting it. I walked into the monastery, blood dripping from my hands. Left prints on every wall, every book, every altar. Marked it not as a tomb, but as a womb. Because this was no longer Vlad's home. It was mine, and I would birth a new myth here. That evening, a man came from the outside. A journalist. American. He had snuck in through the woods, bypassed the watchers. His face was thin, eyes hungry, camera shaky. He found me in the library. Alone. Calm. He raised his lens. I said nothing. He asked, "Is this a cult?" I smiled. "No. This is clarity." He asked again, "Are you claiming to be Vlad the Impaler reborn?" I walked toward him slowly. "No," I whispered. "I'm something worse." He ran. We let him. Because belief spreads best through the mouths of the terrified. He published his piece 3 days later. Went viral in under 12 hours. Hashtags exploded. Hashtag the architect. Hashtag blood inheritance. Hashtag he returns. Hashtag the black gospel. Hashtag obey quietly. We didn't trend. We infested. The world tilted. Not all at once. But cracks began to show. Politicians quoted lines from my writings, not knowing the source. Influencers wore the sigil without meaning to. Celebrities posted cryptic captions that mirrored my doctrine almost word for word. We weren't spreading. We were awakening. Vlad had tried to carve his legacy in flesh. I carved mine in culture. Ilinka died that night. In her sleep. Peaceful. Mouth parted. Eyes open, staring at the ceiling like it had whispered something just before her heart stopped. I buried her beneath the chapel. No ceremony. No tombstone. Because she was the ritual. She was the voice that cracked the silence. And now, she was inside the walls, with the others. I stood alone in the bell tower, watching the valley below. Fires dotted the horizon. Distant cities burning not from war, but from conviction. Because when people believe they are chosen, they ignite. And the world? It burns beautifully when it's sure of its purpose. I heard the final knock that night. 3 slow pounds on the stone chamber door. I turned, expecting a follower. Instead, I saw myself. Not in the mirror. Not in dream. In flesh. Identical. Older. Smiling. He said nothing. He just held out the journal. I took it. Opened it. Blank pages. And one line scratched into the first. Now it begins again. I closed the book. Took a deep breath. And I understood. Vlad was never the monster. He was the invitation, the blueprint. And I was the one who read it correctly.